Educational Service and Public Interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Social Security when we come back. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 40% of what you create and produce. Government gets about 60%. That's $20,000 for you and about $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of special? But if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government will get 75%. Now, that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to get $4,000 more or 8% more take-home pay than you did this year. That's guaranteed and granted by Congress, of course, and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners, and that's where you're at $100,000 a year. Top 5% of income earners, and then only net 25% of it? Come on, boys and girls, surely we got to be smarter than that. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with this kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information that answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is we pay so much and receive so little in return. Let me teach you how to do just that in my tax and status school. Now, that school is available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. To order your free general law CD package in the meantime, why don't you just call direct 417-273-4967 and order yours. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, or you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, George Bush has proposed that we go to private accounts in Social Security. Social Security is a big topic. It's called the third rail of politics. People that deal in Social Security when they're in politics are afraid that the voters are going to throw them out of office. Americans accept Social Security today like we invented the stuff. It's been around since 1935, when it was created by the New Deal administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It's a pay-as-you-go program. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's not self-sustaining. Ultimately, it will collapse. Mathematically, it cannot continue forever. But like any Ponzi scheme, it can go on for a long time. And we're at the end of the Social Security Ponzi scheme. So George Bush, in my view, at least, is correct in his assumption, or his assertion, however you want to word it, that Social Security needs to be fixed. And so his solution is, well, let's turn all that money over to Wall Street. I'm not quite so sure that I want to participate in Wall Street. But I don't want to participate in Social Security either. And I'm one of the very few people that I've ever met that doesn't participate in Social Security, although there are 14 million of us, not a whole bunch, but there's quite a few. You have 290 million people in the country, and 14 out of that 290 million don't participate in Social Security. That's about 5% of us. 95% do. The few people that don't participate in Social Security are religious kooks, Amish and Mennonites and a few other odd, peculiar people, and a few probably of the aristocratic intelligentsia. I doubt seriously that many of the Rockefellers, Morgans, Harrimans, etc. have Social Security numbers. Social Security is a voluntary program. You have to volunteer for Social Security to become a taxpayer under the income tax system, Title 26. The two go together. We'll talk about that as we progress along. Most people want Social Security, so it's not a problem. For those few of us that don't want Social Security, it poses quite a problem. And so, of course, why would you want to avoid something that is so universally accepted? And then on top of that, what are the benefits that you derive from it? I mean, after all, you're paying in 16.1% of everything you create and produce. 16%. Then you qualify for the income tax, which takes another minimum 17%. Now, that's a third of everything that you create and produce going to these two taxes, and there are 14 taxes for you to pay. 14, not just one or two. And out of these 14 taxes, it consumes, depending upon your status in life, of course, and what you're doing, anywhere from 50 to 75%. And most Americans derive some benefits from these tax programs that they participate in. You know, you pay gasoline tax and you drive on paved highway. And there's an example of it. You pay into Social Security and then you retire on Social Security, or if you get killed, then your family is entitled to a death benefit and so on. Now, most people believe in insurance. Not very many of us avoid insurance. Most of us like Social Security, or at least we're ambivalent. We're not for it. We're not against it. And I'm opposed to it. I don't want any part of it. I opted out of it. And I'll tell you why as we progress along. But let's take a look at Social Security. It's a number. And it's a license. you have to have this license or the social security number to work. Many people think it's the law. You have to have a social security number. It's the law. I've been told that more than once. I was in a doctor's office one time, and a young woman, when she asked me what my social security number was, I wrote on the form there, N-O-N-E, and she said, it's the law. And I said to her, I said, well, I didn't know that. Do you know where that law is located? And she didn't. And I said, I don't know either. But I'm guilty. I'm guilty. I don't have one. And I'll go along quietly, just call the police and have them arrest me and haul me away because I'm one of those people without a social security number. Well, the state may require private individuals to obtain a state-created franchise, such as a license, to work for the state or any of its corporate creations. A corporation, which is a creature of the state, can be compelled to require a prospective employee to possess a social security number. The social security number is evidence of a state-created franchise, and they can do that prior to hiring you, the applicant, for that job. And that's because an individual has no common law right to work for a corporation. Working for a corporation is a privilege granted by the state. Corporations are a creature of the civil law. Corporations don't come from the common law. They don't come from Moses or the scripture or the common law of Alfred the Great. And the common law does not recognize corporations created under the civil law jurisdiction. Corporations are juristic state-created persons, and under corporate law, the creator of the corporation, that is the state, can demand anything that it desires from its creation, such as regulation by statute and taxation. The state can even destroy a corporation by use of taxation. We see that in Enoch versus Williams, cited at 370 U.S. verse, or chapter 1, or page 1. Enoch versus Williams, explain that to you. So just as a state employee must obtain a social security number and pay an income tax on the privilege of working for the state, the individual free man who is otherwise unenfranchised must admit to enfranchisement to work for the state or one of the state's corporations. Now, those people who apply for and receive a social security number have applied for and received a privilege from government for which an excise tax can be levied. The income tax is an excise tax. It's a privilege tax. Proof of participation is the social security account number. Therefore, the social security number is a quasi-license. It's a contract to work for all of those who want to work for the state or for one of its corporations and has the effect of extending the state franchise to the employee. Participation in the social security welfare system, as well as the privilege to receive entitlements such as unemployment insurance or welfare and food stamps, are congressionally granted benefits. They're a privilege. They accrue to participants in the program. If you are not a holder of a social security number, you can't get unemployment insurance. You can't get welfare, food stamps, or aid to families with dependent children. Any privilege granted by government is a proper subject of taxation, and the benefits are in effect subsidies of certain privileges, such as minimum wage or unemployment and compensation insurance. There are 108 benefits provided under the Social Security program. The costs of these benefits can be levied upon such privileges as an indirect or an excise tax. Now, since the corporation is nothing more than an extension of the state, its employees, that is, employees of the corporation or employees of the state, can be forced to voluntarily obtain a social security number as a federal license to work for a corporation and franchise. You can see that in U.S. versus Flora, cited at 362 U.S. 145. You can be forced to voluntarily accept and use Federal Reserve notes in payment of that consideration or just compensation of the debt arising among and between the employee, the corporation, and the federal government. You can be required to pay the federal tax debt arising from this franchise in Federal Reserve notes. You can be compelled to provide information and file a return, and to file an IRS W-4 form upon employment, which is a contract of franchise, an expectation and promise of payment of the tax due at year's end. Now, the reason that the Social Security account number operates as a franchise tax is that, first of all, the payments are matched by the employer, which is a state-created corporation, resulting in reduced net tax revenue by way of deductions. And number two, the payments from the employee and the corporation go into the general fund. These payments do not go into a special protective fiduciary fund, as has been so widely advertised, like the Social Security Trust Fund. That's a lie. And number three, the expectations of the employee are addressed to receiving benefits from the general fund. Now, receiving benefits from the general fund is a franchise in itself because when we retire on Social Security, we're paid out of the general tax revenues, not some trust fund. You don't have a box somewhere with $100 bills in it with your name on it. Social Security is not insurance. It's a social welfare scheme, so says the Supreme Court in Fleming versus Nestor at 363 U.S. 603. And the Social Security account number operates as a taxable franchise. It's your taxpayer identification number. Now, there are no property rights associated with Social Security, and where there are benefits or entitlements without property, there has to be a franchise. And in every known court case regarding state compulsory insurance benefit programs dealing with withholdings such as unemployment compensation or accident disability insurance and so on, corporations are involved. These cases, in effect, hold that a corporation can be compelled to withhold and otherwise participate in such programs. The application and receipt of a Social Security account number by you or any other individual is the admission of jurisdiction by the IRS over the property, over the interests, and the endeavors of that person or individual. Now, the IRS 1040 form is in reality a negotiable instrument in the form of a revivable installment note. Installments are due annually on any state-created franchise, the payment upon which is directly proportional to the extent to which the franchise is exercised as measured by net income, such as the privilege of exercising corporate franchise is that for which the state requires this excise tax. You'll see that in UCA 59-13-1, which is an annual tax. Now, the mere existence of a corporation subjects that corporation to the tax. The amount of the tax is computed according to the extent to which the franchise is exercised, as measured by the net income derived from such use, as is explained in American Investment Company versus Utah State Tax Commission, cited at 101 U.S. 189. Now, the excise tax can only be applicable to corporations and enfranchised persons. We see that in FSC versus STM, cited at 63 Pacific 2nd, page 1062. However, the excise tax is not applicable to persons that are not accepting state-granted franchises. Cases represented by Hale versus Nickel, for instance, cited at 201 U.S. 43, show that a franchise person is regulatable, and that franchised person can be compelled as a matter of law to do that which his creator, the state, requires of him, but that an unenfranchised person cannot be so regulated as he receives nothing from the state. Now, the U.S. government, in reality, is a corporation, and it's a corporation created by we the people. The Constitution of the United States, in reality, is the corporate charter. Now, we the people formed the United States government, and we are its creators. Its corporate charter is the U.S. Constitution, and as the government tries to regulate and protect itself from its creations, the states, the corporations, it's doing no more than the patriots who try to regulate and protect themselves from the creation which we created, and that is our government. Now, the United States government's nothing more than a corporation. Just as in the commercial world, the corporate enterprises are busily engaged in competing with private individuals for economic, social, and political power. Well, this United States corporation is concerned about being gobbled up by its own corporate creatures. So when an individual merges his interests with those interests which are corporate in nature, those corporate interests which are otherwise exempt to a free man now become taxable. You'll see that in Waters versus the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, 160 Fed 2nd, 596. That's Waters v. CIR, 9 Ninth Circuit, 160 Fed 2nd, 596. Well, then, when we become a corporate employee, those wages become taxable. This holds true when more than one individual, that is a class of two or more, or a group of two or more, combine their assets or combine their capital with intent of operating to create a gain. That group, that class, that association is taxable as a corporation, even though it's not recognized as a corporation under state statutes. If you act like a corporation, you'll be treated like a corporation. Number of cases along that line, Burke versus Hopkins, 46 Supreme Court, page 48, be one of the cases to look up. Now, the word taxpayer appears in almost every code. It appears in the statutes, and it appears in court decisions. Codes and cases must relate to a taxpayer and not to a non-taxpayer. And you'll see that in Long versus Rasmussen. There are taxpayers and there are non-taxpayers. Long versus Rasmussen is cited at 281 Fed Reporter 236. This also implies that some persons may well be exempt or immune from this income tax. What if you were a non-taxpayer, as laid out in Rasmussen? So if there is an up, there has to be a down. If there's a black, there has to be a white. If there's a taxpayer, then there must be a non-taxpayer. Now, some persons are exempt, as we see in Hughes versus CIR, cited at 153 Fed 2nd 712, statutes which create rights or entitlements, such as Social Security, where none existed before at common law, should be strictly construed when determining the statutes of persons or the status of persons who are entitled to benefits and who are bound by associated or associations and duties due to pay, to get an account, or pay a tax. You see that in Darnak versus Coal Company, 188 Pacific 15, Long versus Rasmussen, again at 281 Federal Reporter, page 236. Now, persons are not subject to statutes unless clearly within their intent and wording. Now, the courts explain that in State versus Eberhardt, 179 Pacific 853. Acts that are not specifically mentioned in a statute are deemed to be outside the operation of the statute, as we see in Huntsworth versus Tanner, 152 Pacific 523. Making so many dollars per year a requirement for filing does not even imply jurisdiction of the IRS over the unenfranchised individual, for the same is not clearly expressed as in the above cases or statutes. So where penal, criminal, or quasi-criminal statutes are construed, they shall be construed against the government, excluding those not expressly set out. Now you'll see that in State versus Firth, F-U-R-T-H, cited at 144 Pacific, page 907. Now, the possession of a written instrument, such as an IRS Form 1040 form or a W-4 form or Social Security number, providing for the payment of money, is prima facie evidence that the debt contracted therein is in fact unpaid. You'll see that in Northrop versus Knott, cited at 46 Pacific 599. Now, the IRS 1040 return is never surrendered after payment. This, then, is, as a matter of common law of the states which governs federal practices in the absence of federal law in that kind of a circumstance. So if there's no federal statute, there's no federal case to the contrary. And additionally, payment on the return, that is that 1040 form, implies a voluntary act of the debtor looking to the satisfaction in whole or in part of the demand against him. You'll see that principle cited in Detroit County versus Smith, cited at 15 Northwest 39. So the tender, then, of a written instrument, such as a 1040 form, implies recognition of an underlying debt and is tendered in discharge of an existing debt. So when a 1040 form is filed, that person becomes a party to the Social Security franchise, and it's an admission of a debt due to the federal government and a duty to file pay and to provide information forever, unless a dissolution, that is a disconnection of this corporate existence is granted, or we otherwise prove that a corporate or quasi-corporate existence or franchise does not exist. So by putting into practice our common law and then refusing any government franchise in Social Security or unemployment insurance and all government entitlements, we can reclaim our individual rights, our individual property, and our individual liberty as set out in Hale versus Hinkle. Remember, Hale versus Hinkle now cited at 201 U.S. 43. So those who participate or those who partake of the free lunch are not free. Now, it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. So if you want subsidies and you want benefits for government, don't complain about government regulating and controlling you. You'll see that in Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. Taxation is in reality a reasonable means by which regulation may be effected. You'll see that in VZ Bank versus Fenno, cited at 8 Wallace 533. So it appears that regulation is, in fact, intended to prevent poverty in our old age before or due to a loss of spouse, job, or some calamity. And this is accomplished under the Social Security Act. Now, it should be observed that Social Security means private insecurity. And finally, it means social insecurity in the final analysis. So the form and operation of the law is false, and then the true intent and operation is in fact the destruction of the individual and thereby the destruction of our American society and the nation of America. The method that's being employed is ominous, but it's covert. It's not obvious in its operation and form. If benefits to the public or if benefits to a class are to be financed, then that class may be taxed or in some way required to pay for it. So when a class benefits from the general fund and not from a fiduciary program or trust, the power to tax, regulate, and etc. is unlimited. And some examples of government-granted privileges that are, in fact, regulated and taxed under the Commerce Clause are things such as mortgages, Social Security, Federal Reserve notes, government-granted privileges, equitable interests, bank and corporate credit cards, stocks and negotiable instruments, bonds, public business licenses, permits, public interest professions, interest-bearing accounts, checks, insurance, marriage licenses, and citizenship. Remember that there's a clear distinction between the civil law and the common law set forth in Hale versus Hinkle. A clear distinction. Now, in contradistinction to these regulatable and controllable endeavors, such as mortgages, Social Security, and Federal Reserve notes, if you were to look at the opposite to that under the common law, you see, the civil law deals with income, the common law deals with increase. The civil law deals in profit, so the common law deals in property. There's only two forms of law here on planet Earth. You're either practicing the common law, which has its origin in the law of Moses, you know, the old common law, the law of the commoners, or you're practicing the civil law, that is the Roman civil law in its modern practice and form, which comes from Rome, you know, such as our Roman Senate and our Roman architecture and our Roman laws. And we have a choice to make. Now, our forefathers, when they created our Constitution, adopted the common law principles, but they also put into our Constitution the civil law commercial law, that is Article 1, Section 8, giving Congress the power to regulate and tax commerce. Now, the common law is the exact antithesis to commerce. It deals in private property. So there's a choice for you to make. If you want to go into commercial business, you certainly have a right to do that. And most Americans, at least 95%, have gone into commercial business. And they have social security numbers, which is the prima facie evidence that they're engaged in commerce. Now, back in the 1930s, when this subject of social security came up, there were a number of preachers, you know, basically small independent church ministers and preachers, that recognized immediately that this thing smacks of the mark of the beast that you see in Revelation 16, I believe it is, or Revelation 13. I guess it is chapter 13, around verse 16. You'll see this thing mentioned called the mark of the beast, and you can't buy, sell, or trade without this mark, without this number. And it certainly came to pass. You can't buy, sell, or trade without the number, the mark of the beast. Now, the truth of the matter is, you can deal in property. We always have had the right to deal in property. And the income tax doesn't apply to property. Property has never been assessed or taxed here in the United States. We don't assess or tax property. Property is an inalienable right. Franchise is a privilege. Franchise can be taxed. Excise is a privilege. Excise can be taxed. And then, of course, people use terms inappropriately. For instance, you look at your house and you say, well, gee, you pay a property tax on your house. No, you don't. No, you don't. Your house isn't property, and that's why it's being taxed. If it were, in fact, property, you wouldn't be paying a tax on property. You're paying an ad valorem tax. You're paying a tax on the value of your home. You're not paying a tax on the home. You're not paying an acreage tax, you farmers out there. You're paying a tax on the value of the acreage. Value. Not property. Now, the common law deals with the opposite of these civil law indici. For instance, we'll run through this again. Let's take a look at a mortgage. You know, the opposite to a mortgage is land held in fee simple. That's the common law, an increase opposite to the civil law and income. The opposite of a mortgage is land held in fee simple. The opposite of Social Security is labor. The opposite of Federal Reserve notes is substance. The opposite of government-granted privileges are inalienable rights. The opposite to equitable interest is property. Property rights. The opposite to bank and corporate credit cards is gold and silver, in spite of the fact that they call these credit cards gold cards. It's a lie. Those aren't gold cards. Those are plastic cards that are called gold cards. It's a lie in the same way that sodomites are not gay. Gay is not synonymous with sodomy, any more than a plastic credit card called gold card is synonymous with gold. Now, stocks and negotiable instruments are the opposite of private ownership. Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private business. Permits are the opposite to private rights. Public interest professions are the opposite of common law occupations. Interest accounts are the opposite of substance and chattels. Checks, spelled C-H-E-C-K-S, is the opposite of warehouse receipts and checks, spelled C-H-E-Q-U-E-S. Insurance is the opposite to individual responsibility or strict liability. Marriage licenses are the opposite to patriarchal family. Citizenship is the opposite to a denizen or denizenship. Now, when we deal with mortgages and Social Security and Federal Reserve notes, we deal with the civil law and income, and we pay an income tax, and Social Security is simply a tax that is attached to a franchise that has benefits attached to it. The common law increase doesn't have these taxes. Taxes on land held in fee simple, labor and substance. Inalienable rights, property, gold and silver, private ownership, private property, private business, private rights. You know, you hear people talk a lot about private ownership and private property and private business and private rights, but they don't practice that. They practice stocks and negotiable instruments and bonds and public and business licenses and permits. We should be practicing common law occupations using substance and chattel and warehouse receipts and C-H-E-Q-U-E-S checks instead of C-H-E-C-K-S checks. And we should be practicing individual responsibility, strict liability, patriarchal family, denizenship, gold and silver, inalienable rights, property, substance, labor, land and fee. We don't do that. Well, at least most Americans today don't do that. But that's what we learned from Moses. That's what we learned from our Constitution. That's what we learned from our Republic. That's what we got from our founding fathers. We practiced the common law and increase. And then something happened. Something came about called Social Security. Somebody came along one day and said, well, we ought to have a Social Security program. We ought to have something that deals with this problem of poverty and unemployment and all these social problems that we have here in the 1930s. So Franklin Roosevelt came along and he said, hey, what we need in this country is a Social Security program like all the nations around us. And the people of America said, yea, Lord, we need Social Security. God bless Franklin D. Roosevelt. Well, we're at the halfway point, boys and girls. We're going to stop here, and let me give you a couple of reminders, and we'll be back, and let's take a look at Social Security and the comment upon the voluntary nature of Social Security. Do we have to participate in the Social Security program? Is it the law? Stand by. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Remember, for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org, or just call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. All right, this week we're talking about Social Security. Remember, George Bush wants to privatize it. It's the third rail. They call it the third rail of politics. Well, an old buddy of mine named Larry Beecraft wrote a treatise on Social Security. Actually, it's called a legal brief. A legal brief, you know, when a lawyer writes a piece of paper, he doesn't call it a treatise, he calls it a brief. And I'd like to take credit for it because I'm so smart, but I actually am not all that bright, so I have to rely upon people that are. Larry's one of those. And so one day he sent me this comment upon the voluntary nature of Social Security. Actually, it's quite a few years ago. He sent me a number of these briefs, and I've included that or incorporated that into one of the lessons here in my tax and status school. This happens to be a part of one of those lessons. And so I want to give Larry Beecraft of Huntsville, Alabama, full credit for the material that we're going to cover here. Let's see, Larry Beecraft, he's also got a webpage. And see if I come across it here, I'll share it with you. He's always got some good information on his website. And I think that it's fairly simple, like a Beecraft.com or Larry Beecraft or something like that. Why don't you just look up Beecraft on the search engine there and see if you can find Larry Beecraft, Huntsville, Alabama. I think you'll be glad you did. Well, he starts off in his brief and he says, today, every day, Americans are constantly confronted with greater and more frequent requests from all too many sources that they provide to the inquiring parties their number of the beast, the Social Security number, that is their SSN. And the examples of this modern-day phenomenon are numerous, and they're known to all of us. Many states are now moving to ostensibly require the display of your Social Security number upon your driver's license. Public school officials demand that school-age children obtain Social Security numbers before those children may be enrolled in any public school. Private parties of all kinds, from banks to employers, deem it essential that they obtain the Social Security number of everyone with whom they conduct any business. Now, with all of these entities making these demands, surely, the law must contain a requirement that everyone have this number of the beast. Or is it possible that everybody simply acts like lemmings, dutifully following the herd instinct without any question? Assuming that such requirement, that you have a Social Security number, without any knowledge of it. Or more simply put, does the law demand that everybody obtain, that everybody apply for a Social Security number, or is such purported obligation nothing more than so much male bovine feces? BS for short. Now, the first inquiry regarding the legal duty to apply for and obtain a Social Security number must involve an examination of the U.S. Constitution and the powers granted therein to Congress. Congress can only possess powers which are contained expressly or by necessary implication within the text of the Constitution, particularly Article 1, Section 8. So being straightforward and to the point, the problem here for Social Security is that no particular clause in this or any other article of the Constitution is sufficient to sustain such power to compel an American citizen to participate in a compulsory retirement or benefit scheme. This power, this alleged power, to thus mandate participation in Social Security must therefore be one which is based upon an implied power. So to determine if this power is one arising by implication, a study of various Supreme Court cases regarding the limits of congressional power, therefore, becomes essential. The states are arguably the governmental entities which might actually possess this inherent municipal police power to compel participation in some type of retirement scheme. But if the states might have this power, an issue which appears to not yet, as so far at least, has yet been decided, does Congress have any corresponding power? Can the Congress assume this inherent power of the state and claim that power as its own? Now, there are 24 cases cited here, and I'm not going to cite all of these, but Larry Beecraft has put 24 cases in here, and I'll just bet you that this document is probably on his website. And as we progress along here, I'm sitting at my desk here doing this program, and I can't jump up now and go get his webpage, but as we progress along, I'll give you Larry Beecraft's website or his webpage. I've got it somewhere around here. Now, here are 24 examples, or 24 cases. Examples of Supreme Court cases which place some real limits upon the powers of Congress are manifold. For instance, in the license tax cases cited at 72 U.S. 462 back in 1866, the Supreme Court held that Congress could not authorize the conduct of business within the states in order to tax that business. In United States versus DeWitt, which is cited at 76 U.S. 41, decided in 1870, the Supreme Court held that a penal regulation in a tax act could not be enforced in a state. In United States versus Fox, cited at 94 U.S. 315, back in 1877, the court held that the United States could not receive property by way of a testamentary device contrary to state law. Then, in United States versus Fox, cited at 95 U.S. 670, decided the next year in 1878, a penal statute remotely related to bankruptcy laws was held inapplicable in the states. In Patterson versus Kentucky, 97 U.S. 501, decided in 1879, the court held that U.S. patent laws conferred no superior rights within the states. In United States versus Staffen, cited at 100 U.S. 82, 1879, federal trademark legislation unconnected with interstate commerce was held inapplicable inside the states. In Baldwin versus Frank, cited at 120 U.S. 678, certain penal federal civil rights legislation was held unenforceable within a state. In Ex parte Burris, 136 U.S. 586, the court held that domestic relations matters were solely state concerns. In Hammer versus Dagenhart, 247 U.S. 251, decided in 1918, the court held that congressional attempts to regulate and control manufacturing activities in the states were unconstitutional. And I could go on and on here and cite, you know, a bunch more. But here we're talking about cases that go back to 1866 and up through, listen to this, as recently as United States versus Butler, 297 U.S. 1, 1936. The court held that Congress had no direct power to regulate agricultural production within the states. And finally, in Oregon versus Mitchell, 400 U.S., page 112, cited 1970. It was held that Congress could not dictate voter qualifications to the states. Now, all of these above decisions, and many that I haven't cited here, as well as others, do place severe restraints upon the powers of Congress. So, boys and girls, if you thought Congress had carte blanche, they don't. And the courts have reined them in over the years. Does Congress have the power to create Social Security? Absolutely. And in two key cases back in the 1930s, Davis versus Halvering was one. A couple of corporations came in and questioned this authority of Congress to create Social Security, and the Supreme Court said certainly. And it's a corporate tax. The Social Security tax, in reality, is a tax on corporations for which the individuals that work for those corporations act in a corporate capacity. That's why you have to have a Social Security number in order to work for a corporation. It isn't the government that comes out here and puts a gun at your head and says, get a Social Security number, we'll blow you away. It's when you turn 16 and you want to work at McDonald's or you want to work someplace and you walk in, and the employer requires that you get a Social Security number. It's not the government that's requiring this number. It's your employer, the guy you want to work for. And he says, I won't hire you without one. And as recently as about 2,000, 5 years ago, the Supreme Court in 2 or 3 cases came out and said, yeah, a corporation can require a Social Security number, and you can't sue that corporation for a discriminatory policy in employment if they won't hire you. You can't punish the corporation. It's not an unfair labor practice for a company or corporation to require a Social Security number. Now, you and I don't have to get one, but if we don't have one, we can't work for General Motors. That's what the bottom line is. And, of course, people want to work for General Motors. They want to work for McDonald's. They want a job in a Burger King. And for all of you people that want employment, and after all, President Bush in his last election said, what Americans want are jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, listen, for all of you Americans out there that want jobs, 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 get out there and get your Social Security number. Now, some of us don't want a job. I'm one of those. George Gordon does not want a job. I avoid employment like I avoid AIDS, herpes, and VD. But I'm not opposed to people who want jobs, but oftentimes people will call the law school hearing and they'll say, well, you know, I don't want to pay this income tax. Well, okay. I don't like the Social Security and income tax and OSHA and EPA and workman's compensation and all these thingies over here that are attended to it and minimum wage and hard-toed shoes and hard hats. Well, listen, boys and girls, you know, if you get involved in a regulated enterprise, you're going to be regulated. That's just where reality's at. Now, we have choices that we make in life. And if you make a choice, you know, then there's going to be some side effects that go along with it. That's all. Well, Larry Beecraft goes on to say that the genesis of Social Security is the events of the Great Depression. While that era saw extraordinary unemployment and a tremendous decline in national production, still it was not as cataclysmic as other events in our nation's history, like the Civil War, for instance. Further, no constitutional amendment was adopted during this era, which can offer any basis for an expansion of congressional power. The legislation which started Social Security back in 1935 must be viewed in light of the various Supreme Court cases decided within a few decades of that legislation prior thereto. So when Congress adopted the Social Security Act in 1935, the Supreme Court had already held in Railroad Retirement Board that Congress had no authority to establish a retirement scheme through its most tremendous power, its control over interstate commerce. So additionally, the revolutionary acts of Congress adopted in the two preceding decades had been emasculated in a series of Supreme Court decisions. Are we to suppose that against this legal background, Congress decided to enact legislation of the caliber which had been struck as unconstitutional in that same year? Well, in the Social Security Act, Congress imposed excise taxes upon employers, and those tax receipts were to be deposited with the Treasury. The Social Security Act further provided schemes whereby participants could enjoy unemployment and retirement benefits. So when the Act was adopted, parties opposed to Social Security and these other welfare schemes attached thereto made challenges to the Act, relying upon some, if not all, of the various cases cited above. Now, the major arguments mounted against the Social Security Act were premised upon invasion of states' rights. So in Steward Machine Company versus Davis, cited at 301 U.S. 548, back in 1937. An employer challenged the unemployment tax imposed upon it, and the court held that such tax was an excise tax which Congress could impose. So they create a tax, which is called a Social Security tax, and they impose it upon an employer, which comes under Hale versus Hinkle. We'll talk about Hale versus Hinkle as we progress along here. And I'll show you that the government has always had that power. Government's not exercising powers that it doesn't have. It's just that they've conned you into participating in programs that you didn't need to join. Now, if you want Social Security and you want to participate in the program, you want to be a member of commerce, well, then pay the tax. Sit down, shut up, ride the back of the bus, look out the window, and enjoy the view. Now, if you don't want to participate in it, then get the hell off the bus. Get out there and get your own bus. Get out there and get your own transportation. So keep in mind now, in Steward Machine Company versus Davis, then, an employer challenged the unemployment tax. It's not an employee going in and saying, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to participate in Social Security. It was an employer that went in and said, hey, we don't want to participate in Social Security. And the court said, well, you got to, because, you know, you don't have any rights. You're a corporation. You're under Hale versus Hinkle. This is a tax which Congress could impose upon these corporations. So in reference to the contention that the subject matter of the act was properly within the historical field reserved to the states, the court held that Congress could enact legislation to aid the states in an area of great concern. The court placed considerable emphasis upon the fact that the states were reluctant to adopt unemployment acts because such taxes created differentials between states which had such legislation and those which did not. By creating a national unemployment act, this difference was eliminated and a great benefit to the American people resulted. The court, therefore, found nothing constitutionally objectionable to the act. All right, now in Halvering versus Davis, 301 U.S. 619, decided the same year, 1937, the same rationale was used to uphold the retirement features of the Social Security Act. The importance of these two cases upholding the Social Security Act concerns the issues which these cases raised. But neither of these cases addressed the issue of whether there was a requirement for any American to join Social Security. Did you get the drift of that? There's nothing in these two cases that addresses the issue of whether or not you have to join or have to have a Social Security number. These two cases address separate issues. One, unemployment insurance, the other, Social Security benefits to the workers, are addressed by corporations that went into court and said, we shouldn't have to pay this tax. And the court came back and said, well, certainly, corporations should have to pay this tax. It's an excise tax. It's a privilege tax. But it doesn't address the issue of whether or not you as a worker have to have this number. Now, what we found out later, that is about the year 2000 or so, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on the subject of, well, if you don't have this number, can you work for a corporation? And the answer to that is, yes, you can if the corporation will hire you. But if the corporation won't hire you, you can't make them hire you. You can't make the corporation do something that they don't want to do, that is hire you without a social security number. They can if they want to. And there's a device known as the suspense fund. And you can have your social security taxes paid over to this suspense fund for people who don't have social security number. But if you walked into court and you sued an employer or a prospective employer because he wouldn't hire you because of some job discrimination, you know, that's going to fall on its face. So the Supreme Court's weighed in on that subject. But you don't have to have the number. You don't have to work for a corporation. You don't have to join Commerce or Corporate America. Now, the reason that this issue was not raised is because there's no such requirement, unless, of course, one works for a state government which has contracted into Social Security. So if you went to work for a state government, and you'll see that in public agencies opposed to Social Security entrapment versus Heckler, decided in 1985, then that issue might come up as you deal with a state or a state government. The above review should readily demonstrate that there is indeed a real question concerning the point of whether one must submit an application to join Social Security. The cases which challenged the constitutionality of Social Security simply did not raise this issue of mandatory enrollment by employees. And it appears that no cases have as yet dealt with that question. The reason for this absence of a challenge to such alleged requirement can only be explained by analyzing the act itself to determine if there is such a requirement, because Congress lacks the constitutional authority to compel membership in Social Security. The act simply imposes no such requirement. There's no such requirement that you or I join Social Security. Now, I've been out of the Social Security program since 1980. I dropped out in 78, and then I resigned my commission in 1984. I have never even received a letter from the IRS or Social Security. They don't care about me at all. Well, evidently they don't care. They don't write to me. But let me tell you, when I was in corporate America operating the Atlantis Manufacturing Company, gosh, I got letters all the time from Social Security and the IRS and the EPA and the State Tax Commission and, you know, every government agency from Boise, Idaho to Washington, D.C., 28 and all, little company called Atlantis Manufacturing, dealing with 28 agencies of government. And one day I woke up and I said, you know, I'm not going to do this forever. So I opted out. Well, listen, we're about out of time here in lesson one, or program number one here, dealing with Social Security. So let's break right here, and we'll come back next time talking about Larry Beecraft and the brief that he wrote as to whether or not Social Security is a requirement. Is there a law that says you have to belong to Social Security? Well, the answer is no, there isn't. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States or heard worldwide over the Internet. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, God willing. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.